Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, May 19th, 2014, during a live teleform conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's teleform conference call. Today, our teleform is on the new book by Berkeley Law School Professor John Yu, Point of Attack, Preventative War, International Law, and Global Warfare. Global Welfare, I'm sorry. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, we're recording today's call for use as a podcast in the future. We welcome to our call today two experts, our author John Yu and commenter Professor Michael Lewis. John C. Yu is the Emanuel S. Heller Professor of Law, University of California, Berkeley School of Law, and, as I mentioned, author of Point of Attack. Professor Michael Lewis is a professor of law at Ohio Northern University, Claude W. Pettit College of Law. And I want to point out that the link to the book, the Amazon page of the book, was available in the notices you got for today's call. It's also available on the Federalist Society's Teleform webpage. We're going to hear opening remarks first from Professor Yu, then Professor Lewis, of about 5 to 7 minutes. Then we'll have the usual back-and-forth discussion between our two guests. But as always, we're going to be turning to our audience for your questions, so please be ready with those questions. And with that, Professor Yu, the floor is yours.
Dean, thank you so much for that invitation and introduction. And it's great to take part in this Federal Society teleforum. I just had a wonderful time seeing a lot of the officers of the Federal Society over the weekend at the Western Leadership Conference. And it was great to see how lively and vibrant Federal Society is, both amongst the students. I see that all the time at Berkeley, but also amongst the lawyers' chapters, too. My book really was an effort to make sense of the wars of the last 10 years, the Afghanistan War, the Iraq War, our intervention in Libya, and to think about how the rules of international politics, and particularly international law on the use of force, should be changed to handle the threats in the future. The basic quick answer about the book's thesis is that as the Russian intervention or invasion of the Crimea and its continuing destabilization of eastern Ukraine show, is that the current international system based on collective security has failed. It's failed for several reasons. One is that I think it made a fundamental mistake, and this was really introduced by Woodrow Wilson with the League of Nations and then was sort of codified by Franklin Roosevelt at the end of World War II in the UN Charter. It's the idea that the use of force in international politics was a criminal act, that it was akin to violence in domestic affairs. The problem with that, of course, is that in domestic affairs, as you know, many people who are members of the Federal Society would first think of, is that in domestic affairs we have a government that has monopoly on legitimate violence, and that we have a system of courts, police, and prosecutors that prevent people from and punish people for using force illegally. We don't have a system like that in the world. And so to try to use the thinking of the criminal law as a way to regulate international politics, I think, is just a fundamental mistake. I think it is also a mistake historically, because the people who have tried to create or establish the idea that the use of force in world affairs is illegal except in self-defense or when authorized by the UN Charter tried to draw on the idea of just war theory that had been discussed and debated from Cicero through the Middle Ages, and many great philosophers and thinkers and lawyers developed a whole host of doctrines and theories about just war that went well beyond this simple notion that force was just something to use in your self-defense. They discussed humanitarian intervention, they've discussed preventive war, preemptive war, and so on. And when the concept was reintroduced in the 20th century by a Woodrow Wilson or Franklin Roosevelt, they reduced it to almost a caricature of what it had been in all of its complexity and theory. excuse me. And then the third, I think, mistake about the use of force in the sort of post-World War I and World War II era was that, I referred to this before, institutionally it's failed. The UN system just is not a successful system because of the veto of the permanent members of the UN Security Council. It becomes impossible to actually use force in any area of the world where one of the five great powers on the UN Security Council have an interest. And so you see that with the Russian invasion of Ukraine right now. You have, I think, an aggressive invasion, basically, of one sovereign country by another, clearly in violation of use of force rules, but the Russians can veto any action or resolution by the United Nations to respond. So what does that mean? The last point then is, what does that mean about the future? First is, I think that in thinking about the kind of rules we should have for the use of force, we shouldn't be so concerned about what the people at the ends of World War I and World War II were concerned about, which was war between the great powers. They obviously should have been, because they had just lived through two of the most destructive wars in human history. But the big secret is that since 1945, there have been no direct wars between the great powers. Amazing story is that since 1945, the number of deaths from war between countries has fallen to a historical low since the beginning of the modern nation-state system in the 17th century, by an order of magnitude. But I don't think that has anything to do with international law or the UN or things we're talking about today. I think that has a lot to do with the presence of nuclear weapons, with the deterrence of the superpower competition, and now since the 1992, the stabilizing role of the United States all around the world to promote a system of peace and trying to spread market principles and democracy. We are actually living through a period of a long peace. The problem is that the international system, because it worries so much about those wars, it doesn't focus on the future problems where force could be a good thing. And here you think about wars involving weapons of mass destruction proliferation, wars to stop human rights disasters, like I think the best example is Rwanda, where 1 million people died when 5,000 or 6,000 Western troops could have stopped the genocide. You could talk about rogue nations, and you could talk about terrorist groups. These are all areas where I think the use of force can be helpful, can actually enhance global welfare. But the rules that we have now, which are so obsessed with stopping any great power war, actually are over-inclusive. They also block a lot of interventions that might be a positive. And so I would say, you know, we're seeing that today, finally, with the Ukraine, where if there's going to be anything to stop Russia, it's not going to be international law, it's not going to be the United Nations. It'll be the United States working with its European allies to deter the Russians and hopefully to force them back out of the Crimea. But at the same time, we should have, I think, a loosening of the rules so that they can allow the United States to take a more aggressive stand on places like Syria or places like Iran, where use of force in a earlier, more discreet, probably narrower way could head off something that would be much worse for the world. But right now, international law and the UN Charter prohibit the United States and its allies from taking that kind of action. So I think this is a classic area where the rules need to be updated and changed because the circumstances and the facts of the world around us have changed. So thanks, Dean, very much for letting me have that opportunity to introduce the book, and I look forward to Professor Lewis's comments.
Professor Lewis.
Hi. Thank you, Dean, and the Federalist Society for allowing me to talk about this book and to review or give my impressions of it, and thank you to Professor Yu for sharing the podium with me on this. And at the outset, I think it's absolutely right that the core thesis that Professor Yu advances is correct. The collective security or world security that the United Nations promised clearly has not come to pass, and it's in large part because of the structure that the UN has, with the the permanent five members of the National of the UN Security Council, France, Great Britain, China, Russia, and the United States, having a veto over any what would be termed legitimate use of force outside of self-defense. And I think Professor Yu is absolutely right to focus on the origins of this and how they have kind of twisted or perverted the idea of just war theory. They try to go back and say, we are looking at or we are drawing on this long history of what legitimate war has looked like. But that's not what the UN Charter allows for. UN Charter does not allow for just wars. The UN Charter allows for wars that the big five powers can agree upon, and that's about it, which is essentially naked self-interest politics and nothing more than that. If you can get Russia, China, the United States, Great Britain, and France to agree on something, then under the UN Charter, you could essentially do whatever kinds of things you wanted to from a use of force standpoint. And I don't think that makes those wars right. And the fact that, as in places like Kosovo in the past, or Syria now, or to a certain extent Libya, although Russia and China backed off on that, you have nations that are going to prevent or vote against or veto any use of force in places where there is some sort of self-interest for one of the big five, means that uses of force for what used to be termed just war ideas are largely not going to be allowed to happen. Now, there was an attempt to change this with the Responsibility to Protect Doctrine that was kind of introduced and debated in the United Nations around the middle of the last decade. And the idea there was to kind of reach back to some of the just war roots, although it may not have been termed or cast in exactly that way. But the idea was to say, if you can get a coalition of states that are acting for sort of the right reasons to improve the humanitarian outcomes in certain situations, then maybe exceptions to the UN Security Council system might be contemplated. But the World Outcome document that concluded that debate and discussion ended up putting us right back where we started, which was saying that ultimately you can do all of these things and use all of these factors discussed in Responsibility to Protect as long as the UN Security Council ends up approving it, which essentially puts us, as I said, right back where we started. I also agree with Professor Yu's idea that if this system is broken, something needs to change. And he posits that there must be good uses of force. And he describes some of those and talks about a way of assessing when force could be used outside of the UN Charter system in a way that would be improving of global welfare. That's sort of the standard that he posits, that if you can show that the expected benefit to global welfare is greater than the expected cost to global welfare by going to war and using force, then you should be allowed to use force. And theoretically, very sympathetic with that idea. I think practically it is going to be a very difficult hurdle to get over, though. It, as you can imagine, sounds very much like sort of a law and economics view of how to determine when such uses of force would be legitimate or legal. And you're weighing welfare, expected benefit, expected cost. The problem is that most law and economics is dependent upon the idea of perfect information, or at least something close to perfect information, in order to get those calculations correct. And I think when you were talking about things like international relations and great power politics, religious and or ethnic tensions and strife, the availability of perfect or even good information is often hard to come by. And the problem with this is that ultimately, if we're going to do something like this, you're going to have to go to the world community and make the case that your use of force is comporting with greater benefit to global welfare. And so you're going to have to say, here is what the expected cost was of us doing nothing. And here is the advantage of us doing something, and you need to basically make the rest of the world believe that. And I think Rwanda is a great example of this in a tragic way and also in a cautionary way. I think that in retrospect, there is little question that a very small number of people could have made a very big difference there, whether it's 5 or 10, 15,000, whatever, Western soldiers of some kind could have gone in and prevented hundreds of thousands of civilian deaths. And yet the problem is that it's a counterfactual. We know that we didn't do it, and we see what would have, what has happened as a result of that. But if we had intervened, we have to go back and think how that would have been viewed. If we had got a coalition of states, France, Belgium, the United States, the United Kingdom, others, and sent in a force and prevented a genocide there, we would have had to try to convince the world that we had saved a million lives and that a million people would have been killed by machetes and small arms and if we had not intervened. And I suspect that the rest of the world, particularly those that aren't going to look at this use of force charitably, would find that incredible. And they would have said, that is ridiculous. You did not save anywhere near that many lives. There's no way that you could prove you would have. And what we do know is that you killed some of these people that shouldn't have died, and that you are engaged in a neocolonialist adventure in Africa, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that that counterfactual side of things is going to make any intervention a very difficult thing to do and gain world support, because you may, in all good faith, come to the conclusion that you're improving world welfare by doing so, and you may well be doing so. But you're going to have to convince others of that, and that's going to be very difficult to do, because all you're going to be able to show them is the people that were killed in your intervention, and you're going to have to make everybody else believe that this was worth it somehow against some counterfactual that you can never truly establish.
Professor Yu, you want to respond?
Yeah, I think Professor Lewis, and also let me say thanks to Professor Lewis for his excellent comments and praise him for making his way through the whole book. I'm impressed. it's hard enough for me to have to read it, too. So thanks very much, and I don't know if people know this, but Professor Lewis was a combat pilot in Iraq and was in the Top Gun school, so I've always been wanted to be on a forum with someone who's been played by Tom Cruise. It's very exciting for me. Three points. So one, I completely agree. Professor Lewis is right. Even if you adopt this kind of cost-benefit approach to when wars are good and should be allowed by the system, and wars are bad and should be prohibited by the system, it's hard to measure them. And so one analogy to this is the time when law and economics came along to the normal common law fields like contract. And it used to be thought you had to obey your contract because it was a promise, and that would be illegal because it was immoral not to live up to your contracts. Even if, and people like Richard Posner and so on showed later, even if it was better for the country if you were to breach your contract when it was efficient to do that and pay damages to the first contract holder and sell your product to someone who wants to pay more. it's easier to calculate the differences when it's more efficient to breach a contract than it is international politics. So I completely agree with that. I mean, we do have similar problems when we try to engage in regulation today, of course, when we try to figure out pollution levels or safety features for cars, or we have to make all kinds of difficult judgments about how many lives are going to be saved, how much each life is worth. And, one fact always stuck with me. There was a study done which showed that each agency, when it does regulations, had very, wildly different values they were placing on each human life saved by some regulation, which is incredible that the government doesn't have one single standard. So I completely take that point. I think that's right. I think, however, at least there are going to be some cases, I think, which are going to be easier than others. And so at the very least, we should move to a system where this is the right question rather than banning all war, no matter how much benefit there would be. So I think Professor Lewis is right that Rwanda has difficulties to it, but I still think even with higher costs than the 5,000 troops or the 7,000 troops, to save a million lives in that African country would have been worth some level of cost, much more than anything we actually ended up incurring. And you know, at least that we could take those into account and ask the right questions rather than just saying, oh, no, all of those are prohibited. The second point, I think also Professor Lewis's point about having to go to the world community, I would approach it differently but in a similar vein, which is that this is why alliances can be useful and helpful. You know, I'm not making a case that the United States ought to do this all the time by itself. In fact, in the book, I argue that there should be an alliance or a concert of democratic countries that go into this together. But the reason why is, one thing, of course, is that alliances spread costs. And so when the United States went into Iraq, we actually had a number of nations with us. And some of those nations helped spread the burden of the war by contributing financially or helping in different missions. And certainly in the first Gulf War, there were countries that just paid money to help support the cost of the war because they saw that it was a benefit for the world for Saddam Hussein to be removed from Kuwait. But the other thing alliances show is that if you have alliances, you have other countries then which have looked at the same facts and have a similar view on the costs and benefits to the extent that they're willing to risk the lives of their men and women in uniform. And so alliances can also be helpful in reassuring, I think this is Professor Lewis's point, helpful in reassuring other countries that the United States is not out there to conquer territory or to pursue its narrow self-interest. I think the thing actually striking is that in a lot of these wars, the United States has had some self-interest. I mean, it would be amazing if the United States didn't, but that a lot of these wars have redounded to the gain of many other countries around the world in terms of improved stability and security and market stability in a way that we don't even reap most of the benefits. And so, so at the institutional level, I would make the case for having a concert of democracies, but the important thing is that one that only allows in the democracy so that countries like Russia and China don't continue to use their veto to protect the worst countries like the Assad regime in Syria, which reportedly just used chlorine gas on its own citizens again. I argue in the book that Russia and China have used their veto in the Security Council to act as like a defense bar for dictators around the world. And then I very much like Professor Lewis's point about the just war theory, and I think that's something I tried to do in the book that was out of my normal comfort zone and I thought was fun, and I think there's a lot of area for future work on is to understand how to recapture the just war theory as it developed in the Middle Ages and by a lot of the church thinkers, because when I was going through it, I was really struck by how they had thought about a lot of the same problems that we're facing today. You know, what do you do about a country where the government severely represses its people? You know, they were talking about, what if you had a prince in another country who was just slaughtering his own citizens? Could a just prince intervene and stop it? And so they thought about cases like hypotheticals, and they would go through and try to figure them out. And I think there's a lot of wisdom and learning to be recovered there that we haven't. I do blame Woodrow Wilson for distorting, essentially trying to cover up, but pushing aside those centuries and centuries of thought by making war into this kind of criminal law enterprise. And I think it might be useful. I'm actually curious to see what Professor Lewis would think about some of the cases I talk about at the end of the book, because I think that's how you figure out whether we can use this in the future. It's like, what do you do with cases like Syria, Iran, or North Korea? In the book, I make the case that under this approach, intervention in Syria to stop what's now over 100,000 civilians killed, and to remove this regime would be a case where global welfare would be advanced. I also make the case that limited strikes in Iran to stop the Iranian regime from acquiring nuclear weapons would be a legitimate use of force.
I do want to get to, this is Dean Reuter, I want to get to audience questions, but I want to give Professor Lewis another chance to rejoin here.
Well, thank you. Just a couple of quick things then, because I don't want to keep the audience out of this. I fully support Professor Yu's reliance on alliances, because it's absolutely critical for the legitimacy of these actions to at least show some kind of international cooperation, and the broader the alliance, obviously, the better. One of the interventions that we have had was in Kosovo, and Kosovo was something that was illegal because the UN Security Council did not approve it, because Russia would have vetoed any UN Security Council resolution allowing the use of force in Kosovo. But NATO went ahead and did it anyway. And it was because it was NATO doing it and not the United States. I think that added a great deal of legitimacy to it. Also because it seemed to be for the right reasons, for a humanitarian situation. It's not as though NATO was going to annex the territory to itself or anything like that. And so that seems like one example of where Professor Yu's posited intervention standard would have been met, was carried out, and was a force for improving global welfare. I think a more interesting one where we have intervened is Libya, and to look at how that went. I was very, very much for the idea of intervening in Libya when it happened. It seemed like there were going to be an awful lot of deaths if we had allowed Gaddafi to continue doing what he was doing. We had a broad coalition that included not only European allies, but the Arab League. And so when you have a lot of groups coalescing around the idea of force is necessary, that is the prototypical example under Professor Yu's theory where it should happen. And it did happen. It was successful. Gaddafi is gone. But I'm not sure how the world views the results overall. We did kill a number of people over there, and there were some criticisms of the strikes used by the French and the British, particularly against command and control and communications and other air defense systems that were part of that raid that killed some civilians and targeted a number of military groups in ways that some people found to be excessive. I think the jury's still out a little bit, but it's really hard, I think, to say for sure that ex ante, I think Professor Yu's criteria were clearly met there. I think ex post, it is less easy to say so. I would agree that right now it looks like Syria was a place where we should have intervened. Not sure exactly how we would do so now, and not really sure what it would look like if we did so in the long run. But it is something that, very sympathetic with the idea of there being such a thing as good wars, I think that we need to strip away a lot of the UN Security Council's ability to prevent such uses of force. But we have to be very careful as to how we do so, because the world is going to look at whatever is done by anyone, whether it's us or Russia or a concert of democracies, quite skeptically.
All right, let's do check in with the audience. In a moment, we're all going to hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question for Professor Yu or Professor Lewis, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And we've got two callers with questions now, so let's go to our first caller.
Hi, this is Kurt Levy at Committee for Justice. Thanks for a very interesting debate. And John and even Professor Lewis are talking as if we would know when to go to war if we could accurately measure what is efficient, what is good, what is just. I would suggest the problem is much deeper because of different values. Nations and people don't agree on what is good and just. Suppose you could take Sharia law as an example. I mean, suppose a nation is stoning thousands of women who commit adultery or is stoning gay people and killing them. Can we intervene? I mean, most or all Americans certainly think that's wrong, but, you know, do we have the right to impose our moral views on another nation's, or another quick example, maybe, you know, could a nation invade the U.S. because we're killing people under the death penalty, or because we're killing, in some people's views, millions of unborn babies? So I'd ask both speakers to please comment.
I'll go first, John. That's a great question, Kurt. It's great to hear you. And it's one that goes to the heart of people who want to use cost-benefit analysis, not just in this this book, but many other areas of law, which is how do you value certain intangible things, like, as you said, you raise different religious values, political values, over which a lot of people may disagree. So in the book, I try to make more the case that I admit that those are very hard problems, and so I tend to look just more at lives saved first, so that the easier cases for me are like Rwanda, Kosovo. There were actually weren't that many lives lost because we intervened early. We basically waged a preventive war in Kosovo to stop what looked like another set of killings of large numbers of people based on what we'd seen the Serbian regime do in Bosnia and other parts of the Balkans. So I completely agree that that's a very difficult and hard case about when would you intervene, not to stop deaths, not to stop severe, sort of material deprivation, like what we're seeing in North Korea, for example, and whether you would be allowed to intervene for because you want people to live under a different system.
So let me be clear. I actually was talking about deaths. I'm saying you do when people disagree on whether a death is justified. If you talk to a lot of fundamentalist Muslims, or I shouldn't say a lot, but certainly some, they would say killing women who commit adultery or killing gay people is okay. So even if we kill millions, I mean, that's a good, they would say. That's not a bad.
I
would say, how does your theory deal with the fact that whether it's abortion, death penalty, Sharia law, there's just not even agreement on when killing is wrong.
So I think many people would say, right, if you're losing your life, like with our death penalty, as the result of a system of justice that has due process, that's one thing. I wouldn't count those as deaths that are lost that could raise to a level of justification for an intervention. But if you're talking about, for example, the Iraq regime or the Afghanistan regime, where you have people being put to death either because of a dictator's women, he may dress it up as the result of court hearings or a justice system, but we can we can agree that what you're really seeing is the dictator killing off his enemies, or something like Afghanistan, I think, where you had the Taliban, as you say, executing people for adultery or even less. And I do agree. I think that those are cases where intervention must be justified. Now, you're right that different religious systems or different cultures in the world are going to have disagreements over what's legitimate or not. But I think that the United States, I think, already makes these value choices. We do try to promote a certain kind of world and a certain kind of global system where we are promoting market democracy. And I think we shouldn't be afraid to stick to those values and to judge whether other countries are acting appropriately with those values, even if they may use their own value system as a defense. Mike, what do you think?
Kurt, I want to thank you for the question and for participating and jumping in. I think it is very, very difficult and thought-provoking. I think the one place where you can sort of hang your hat on this, though, is that international law does have at least a handful of core beliefs that are broadly agreed upon cross-culturally. The term jus cogens is used to describe a set of norms that, regardless of your religion or your ethnicity or whether you are from the East or the West or the South or the North, you all have at least some belief that certain things are wrong. And whether that be genocide or piracy or slavery or torture, I mean, those are all clear ideas that, that humanity has said, broadly speaking and agreed upon, is wrong. Now, obviously, people will defend certain kinds of killing, and I don't think that Professor Yu's positive use of force could probably come in when you're talking about something like executions under Sharia law, if there is some form of process being used there. As antithetical as that would be to our value system, it would be hard to say that if, you know, tens or hundreds of people were being killed, that that would be something that would trigger an international use of force against a nation doing something like that. Once you're talking about thousands, tens of thousands of deaths, that's a different matter. And that begins to look like a genocide, depending on who it's directed at and why. And if it is political opponents, if it is a racial minority or a religious minority, if it is the Jews in Germany, then you say, yes, the world will intervene, because the world agrees that this is a jus cogens violation. You cannot enslave these people, and you cannot exterminate these people. And when you get to a position that is, it is clear that that is going on, it's a lot easier to say global welfare is improved by the use of force in a situation like that. But it would have to be fairly limited and fairly clear examples for sure.
So it sounds like it is somewhat a quantitative matter. If you're killing, as you say, a few hundred or thousand people because of homosexual practices, we might find that abhorrent, but we would see that more as part of your legal system. If you're, you know, sending out troops to kill a million gay people in your country, then that's, you would say that's genocide. That's not the justice system in operation.
Yeah, I think that's
I would also put it differently, which is that we're talking about the benefits, but you also have to weigh it against the cost. So if the United States were going to try to, you know, use force against another country that was killing some people, not a lot of people, as Michael says, as part of a justice system in their own country under their own laws, it's very likely that the costs of the war are going to outweigh by quite a large amount the benefits you're going to have by stopping a regime like that. But if you talk about a regime, I'll point to North Korea or Afghanistan or Syria, that's killing tens or hundreds of thousands of their citizens. And even though they may dress it up as, right, this is all legal and we have the system which gave them some kind of process and we have laws that say what they did was illegal, but they're killing that many people, then I think the benefits, the costs may still be high, but the benefits of saving all their lives might be much higher.
We've still got three questions now pending, so let's go to our next caller.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. What I haven't heard yet in this discussion is how our Constitution provides a framework for dealing with these issues and references the Law of Nations, which at the time it was adopted, was largely defined in the Peace of Westphalia of 1648 and subsequent developments based upon that, according to which some standards were established for what is and is not a state. And from the same period, we have usage of the word piracy, or its equivalent in other languages, which would make piracy a warlike act of any non-state actor. So we would seem to have, in at least those countries that are not fully functional states, that is to say, which do not maintain effective control over warlike activities from their own territory, that they become thereby, from the viewpoint of our system, piracy, and the laws of piracy would apply. And therefore, although we may not be able to determine in every case whether intervention is justified, we can at least say that this country is not a state in the proper sense. They don't maintain effective control over warlike acts committed from their territories, and therefore we have universal jurisdiction to intervene.
Professor, do you want to respond?
Yeah, John, I think that's a fabulous question. And first, you're right to point out that our discussion and this book does not address the U.S. Constitution and how it interfaces with international law. I'd like to address that, though, now, because I think it's a very important and provocative question. One on the question of methodology, I take you as probably thinking, and if you are, I agree with you, that you're not sure whether if international law changes over time, whether that has the effect of restricting or expanding the legal justifications for the U.S. to go to war, so under the Constitution. So I think if it did have a limit, I would look, as I think you do, at what did the 18th century international law say about being able to go to war or not, and that would be the framework that the framers would have wanted to use to cabin, if at all, the U.S. authority to go to war. And then if you look at that, I think I completely agree with your substantive point, which is that one thing that people did agree on at that time was that only nations should be able to wage war legally. Even this goes back to the just war theories that went all the way back to Cicero, was the idea that you had to be waging war under legitimate public authority, by which by the time of people like St. Augustine or St. Thomas Aquinas came to mean the head of state, a prince or a king at that time. And so I agree with you. So if you were like Al-Qaeda or a terrorist group or some of these other groups we're struggling with around the world right now, they would have qualified. They would have been. They might have been called pirates, maybe, or not, but they would have been thought of in the same category as what they used to call the enemies of mankind. And any country would be allowed to use force to try to put a stop to them. I think it's a harder question if you want to talk about, and I don't take you to make this point, but many people in the international law community, the U.S., try to make this point, which is that somehow international law acts through the Constitution even today to restrict what the United States can do under modern ideas about international law today rather than the 18th century idea. I personally very much disagree with that notion because I don't think the framers of the 18th century could have known what international law would to be like today. I think international law itself has really changed. There's been a very strong effort to shift the creation of international law today away from nation states and their practices towards international organizations and commentators and non-governmental organizations to this kind of loose international lawmaking machinery, which is not really under the control of nation states as it was under the 18th century. And I don't see how the Constitution itself would incorporate, would bring that in. So the United States could always, Congress could pass a law or the president could declare, as I think sometimes President Obama tries to do, that the United States will only wage war consistent with international law now. But I hope you agree with me, I don't think the Constitution would require, though, that our government could only wage war consistent with what the 21st century international law is. And so for me, for example, with Ukraine, it's not clear under international law whether the United States, how much it can actually help Ukraine or how much it can try to punish Russia, because anything that goes through the UN Charter is being vetoed by Russia on the Security Council. But I think international law of the 18th century and our interests and practice would allow us to do a lot to help Ukraine, even short of armed force or sending troops, with sanctions, arming the Ukrainians, terminating the START treaty with the Russians, rebuilding the ABM systems we had planned for Eastern Europe. I think the United States can do all those things. I don't think the Constitution stops this administration from doing that if it had the, if it had the gumption to do it.
Professor Lewis, you want to weigh in here?
Yeah, briefly. I think that's absolutely right. The Constitution would not prevent the U.S. from using force based upon whether or not the UN Charter was being followed. I mean, if that were the case, then the Constitution would have said that the Kosovo operation was illegal, and arguably that the 2003 invasion of Iraq was illegal, because the UN Security Council, while they passed a resolution condemning Saddam Hussein's failure to allow weapons inspectors in and talked about, you know, all necessary measures and that sort of thing, it was clearly not a definitive vote by the UN Security Council to use force, and nations opposing the use of force have claimed that it was in fact illegal. So if the U.S. Constitution required us to go through the UN Charter, then those two examples would already be cases where we had not done so. With regard to piracy, which I think is a good point, you do see that being handled, and you do see force akin to armed conflict being used in places along the Horn of Africa, where you have piracy as a problem in failed states like Somalia, and you have had strikes against pirate havens or pirate areas in those states. And I think the justification for this is kind of what Professor Yu had indicated. It's not perhaps a use of force under the UN Charter, but there is a sense that piracy is one of the global wrongs. It is one of the Juskogen's violations, and you do have a coalition of nations that have gotten together to try to prevent piracy by using their naval forces in that area, and at times, as I said, have engaged in strikes against land targets and bases that the pirates are using there. So I think there is already some evidence that states are at least behaving in the way Professor Yu is saying states should be allowed to behave. Whether that contributes to a move in international law in the direction that Professor Yu is trying to take us, hard to say, but it's certainly reason for some optimism.
If you'd like to join the conversation, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got about 10 minutes left. We've got two questions pending at this point. Before we go to our next caller, let me make a quick announcement. Tomorrow at 12 noon Eastern Time, our teleforum conference call will feature judge and now law school professor Paul Cassell talking about the Paroline case, which concerns damages in a child pornography, a case recently decided by the U.S. Supreme Court. And then Thursday at 4, we'll be speaking with James Allen about his book, Democracy in Decline. In that book, he argues that democracy is being diluted in five of the world's oldest democracies, including the United States. Today, of course, we're talking to author John Yu and Professor Mike Lewis. Professor Yu's book is available on our website, but also the link to the Amazon page is in the notice you got of today's call. With that, let's go to our next caller.
Hi, good afternoon. This is Gary Wheaton. I'm still a student, just about to graduate in the next couple of weeks here. Quick question.
Good for you.
Congratulations.
As a former military member, it's a complete honor to be dealing with the likes of this call. So, I apologize, you answered most of my question already, and so I'll just add to it maybe a little bit. So, for example, if a non-state actor, not in uniform the whole bit, declares war in some capacity against our nation, would that change anything under international law? And also, a separate part of my question here, going back to the Ukraine, if the Ukrainian government asked the U.S. to intervene directly, I think we all know that Europe gets a lot of its energy through the Ukraine, so we might not get a coalition of the willing in that situation. So I guess the two-part question is under international law, if a non-state actor declares war on us, does that change anything? And the other part of it is, if the Ukraine were to ask us for direct help, would that change anything under the laws as well?
I think the first question is a lot easier than the second question. So under the first question, I think that if you have, as you said, non-state actors fighting against us, I don't know whether they have to declare it or not, but if they take hostile action against the United States, I think we have the right to respond and use force. I think that, and this is, of course, goes back to the struggles we've had in our country over how to classify Al-Qaeda legally. You know, in my view, when I was in the Bush administration, you know, 9/11, and then the years since has been that if you have non-state actors who are conducting hostilities against the United States is allowed to consider it war and to use armed force, but that they are illegal combatants or unprivileged combatants or illegal belligerent. You know, there's a whole bunch of different words that basically refer to the same thing, or people who are not fighting according to the laws of warfare. And terrorists and other non-state actors would be examples of that. I think there's there's another school of thought, which I think is mistaken, which thinks that, well, if you're a non-state actor, what you're really doing is something that's criminal, that it's really, you're really acting as if you ought to be treated by law enforcement. I think there's this effort sometimes to consider the world split into either legitimate force against other nations, which we govern by the laws of war, or something like non-state actors like Al-Qaeda, which would have to be treated by the criminal law. And I think you saw a lot of that argument over, you know, again, it still continues, but you saw a lot of the argument over how to handle Al-Qaeda. I think that if you look at what all three branches of our government have decided, at least, we've come to the agreement that a non-state actor like a Al-Qaeda, like a terrorist group, is an enemy that you can use armed force against under the rules of war, but that they are not to be given all the privileges and benefits that someone who fights under the laws of war would be, like this, you know, uniformed soldier of another country. The second question, what if the Ukraine invited assistance? Then I think I agree. I think that's your suggestion. I agree with, is that then under rules of international law that the United States and European countries are providing assistance, the case becomes much, much easier. It still becomes a question, you know, and this is what the Russians are being very good at, is what kind of force is Ukraine actually entitled to use in its self-defense? I mean, personally, I think that they've been invaded by Russia in the area of the Crimea, and Vladimir Putin's efforts to use these kinds of plebiscites about whether to stay part of Ukraine or not, where you've got highly questionable procedures being used for elections. The whole thing reminds me a lot of Nazi Germany under Hitler and what happened in the Sudetenland and in the years leading up to World War II, where you had also, Hitler claimed, well, you had large numbers of Germans living in places like Czechoslovakia or other parts of Eastern Europe, and that Germany as a country had some kind of right to intervene and use military force to protect the rights of those Germans. And in fact, I think Victor Davis Hanson did a great service. He took one of Hitler's speeches about the Sudetenland, I think, and he just replaced the word German with Russian throughout the speech, and it read exactly as if Vladimir Putin had given the speech just a few months ago about the Ukraine. So I think I don't think the hard question is really the invitation by Ukraine for help from us. I'm actually deeply disappointed that our assistance so far has amounted to not much more than MREs, you know, meals ready to eat for the Ukrainian army. But I think the harder issue is going to be for many people is how far can Ukraine use force? And if we were helping them, that would be our right too in assistance. How far can we go in using force? How far can Ukraine go in using force to oppose what Russia has done? I know there's very little appetite in the United States for any troops on the ground, but I try to make the case that there's a lot of things that we can do to help push the Russians out of Crimea and to stop what's doing in eastern Ukraine. I think number one is that we should stop limiting our nuclear arsenal and our strategic vehicles, delivery vehicles, to the same level as the Russians. I mean, we're basically saving the Russians money by agreeing to lower our stockpiles to levels which are starting to raise doubts around the world about the U.S.
security guarantee, particularly in places like Asia. I think that we should take a page from Reagan's book, and you know, he used the ABM deployments to put pressure on the Soviet Union. I think we should restore our ABM systems in Eastern Europe. I think we should pull out of our agreement with the Russians about Syria over the chemical weapons. And I think we should be putting pressure on Russia's allies around the world, increasingly Syria and Iran. All that would be things we could do without having to put any boots on the ground anywhere. Sorry for the long answer, but you really got me going.
That was great. Thank you very much.
This is Dean Reuter again. Let's try and take one more call, although we do have a hard stop in just about 3-4 minutes. So let's check in with our final caller here.
Hi, this is Louis Laverone with the National Association of Attorneys General, and actually a soon-to-be sworn-in attorney.
Good for you, too.
Oh, thank you.
Well, it's never too late to change your mind.
I wouldn't dream of it. I guess this is a good question to wrap things up with. Just, given two considerations, first, the various cases that Professor Lewis put forward about Kosovo and Libya, as well as sort of the discussions that we've had about Syria and Ukraine, at least in public discourse, which focused more on strategic and practical considerations rather than whether or not it's legal to actually intervene in either of those countries. And then secondly, considering that arguably the UN system already contains some just war principles incorporated into the charter, given that there's sort of a baseline for determining what's just in terms of at least self-defense and then breaches to collective security, as well as this sort of dead provision in Article 45 creating basically a rapid reaction force that would create sort of an international policeman. Mm-hmm. Given those considerations, Professor Yu, are the ideas you're proposing in your book really that big of a departure from what we already have in the international system?
That's a good question. I think so, two levels. So one is a level of procedure institutions, and then the second would be the substantive rules. So I think at the level of procedure institutions, you know, you've raised a lot of these interesting things in the charter that could have allowed it to become a more forceful presence in these questions of security. You mentioned the idea of the rapid reaction force. Of course, you know, no countries ever agreed to give the troops necessary to UN command to achieve any of this. And so we actually see the UN, when it does play a role with military force, taking the role of peacekeeping, which, you know, as you know, is actually not really addressed in the UN Charter in a direct way. And so because of the veto, I think institutionally, because of the veto of countries like Russia and China, you're never really going to have any kind of successful UN actions. There's only been very few examples, and those were under unique political periods. And as Professor Lewis pointed out, there are several wars I think we can point to now that were waged in violation of the Charter, which I think many of us could agree were good. But also, I would say, substantively, I do think that I do make the case, and I didn't get to it earlier, but one of the big problems, the loss of life that's occurring in the world today from combat is intrastate. It's coming from inside states, not between states. And the UN Charter, and the current international system, is quite agnostic, if not actually opposed to the idea of intervening inside states to stop large deaths and human rights abuses. Professor Lewis did point out there are things like the responsibility to protect and so on. There have been efforts to update the international law doctrine to allow for more of that. But if you read the UN Charter, you don't see any kind of right for nations to intervene inside another country, a country that poses no threat to its neighbors or no threat of aggression, to stop some kind of large loss of life because of the, you know, the domestic government's policies or because of the actions of a dictator. So I think that's one area where I think I would see I would make the case for the biggest departure from the current international rules.
Well, folks, I'm afraid we're going to have to let that be our final word today. I want to thank Professor John Yu. He's the author of Point of Attack, Preventative War, International Law, and Global Welfare. As I mentioned at the outset and repeated during the program, it's available in the link we sent to you in the notice of today's call. It's also available at Amazon, of course, and on our website as well. I also want to thank Professor Michael Lewis for his comments today. I want to thank the audience as well for dialing in. And to our audience, a reminder about our teleforum conference call tomorrow. But until that time, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.